familiar has a short summary of his evidence for the front page. Quite useful.
That's good.
I don't have the summary.
Not yet.
It's coming sort of archaeologist. And Ms. Ayers is going to take the same.
So the maps I've supplied for this hearing are an exact copy of what was submitted in the evidence on the board label. I've just highlighted a couple of features on each map just because they're key to the evidence. But for all intents and purposes, they're exactly the same as the maps and the evidence.
Okay, Mr. Leary. Same instruction. If you have, just because Mr. Withmore set a precedent, you feel free to sit.
Okay, thank you.
Or stand at your option.
My name is Stephen Francis Leary. I'm a consultant geologist. I've been engaged by Orthington Limited to provide expert geological evidence in relation to their submission on the proposed district plan. In particular, the alignment of the O'Neill line as it passes through the Orthington farm. The following is a summary of my evidence, which is pre-lodged on 4th of April 2017. The following descriptions, please refer to the geological map included as Figure 6 in the evidence. As I just mentioned, you've got another couple of copies with some highlighting features. The geology of Queenstown Lakes District is dominated by two main geological units. The mountains and basement are comprised of Permian schist over 250 million years old, while the valleys and basins tend to be filled with glacial, alluvial, and lake deposits that have been deposited relatively recently over the last few hundred thousand years. The two geological units form distinctly different landforms that reflect the geology and geological processes. The schist that comprises the mountains has been carved by glaciers and eroded by streams and landslides, usually making the slopes steep, rough, and incised by deep gullies and gorges, whereas the depositional processes that deposited moraine, alluvial, and lake sediments on the valley floor have created landforms that tend to be flatter and smoother. At the Hawthornden farm, the geology is relatively simple. The very upper part of the farm is Permian schist and associated landslide debris, while the majority of the farm is comprised of valley floor alluvials with minor terminal moraine. Most of the alluvials are in a composite alluvial fan system that's been named the Alpha Fan. This fan system started to form as soon as the ice receded from the Mount Alpha face, probably during the Albertown Glacier advance 60 to 80,000 years ago. The retreat of the ice allowed streams to erode material from the mountain face and deposit this as alluvial sediment on the valley floor below. It remains active today and is roughly 3 kilometres in width and 2 kilometres in length, running from the base of Mount Alpha to the shores of Lake Wanaka at Lawyers Bay. The contact between the schist of the Mount Alpha face and the alluvial fan sediments is easy to identify as it's both a distinctive break in the slope and also where the surface of the land changes from the rougher and eroded mountain face to the smoother depositional surface of the alluvial deposits below. To the northeast, the fan is interbedded with alluvial outwash gravels and runs up against and partially buries the terminal moraine Wanaka is built on. Both the outwash gravels and moraine were deposited during the last glaciation between 15 and 18,000 years ago, the event that also created Lake Wanaka. The final retreat of the ice from this glacial advance has also created two terraces that cut across the alluvials. As the ice has receded, the water base level in the valley has dropped, and the river systems draining the valley, four side tributaries, have cut down through the alluvial deposits, creating terraces. This glacier-related process means that alluvial terraces are a very common feature across the upper river basin. Alluvial fans are also very common around the basin margins, forming where the flow velocity of streams and rivers rapidly decreases as they exit the steep slopes onto the flatter valley floor. A summary of the alluvial fans of Upper Clutha and Lockton basins was included as figures 3 and 4 within the original evidence. There are at least 16 significant sized fan systems within the basins, and there are over 2,000 within Otago. I think that it is important to note that detailed geological mapping of the area was not conducted before the 2002 Environment Court hearing, and therefore the description of the geology and landforms was not always correct. The hearing focused on a landform described as the Alpha Fan, but incorrectly describes the fan, Alpha Fan, as being restricted to the upper part of the Hawthornland Whānau, a description that may have caused them to include the entire landform as part of a mountain range landscape. But the part of the fan referred to in the hearing is only the upper third of the fan. The fan actually extends to the shores of Lake Wanaka through the Far Horizon, Meadowstone and Saga Drive subdivisions. The position that was described as the toe of the fan during the Environment Court hearing is in fact the upper terrace cuts across the fan. Mapping by the Institute of Geological and Nuclear Sciences, by the Otago Regional Council and by myself, all agree that the true extent of the fan is the lake edge. This, as well as the fan being clearly composed of typical valley floor alluvials, makes the classification of the fan as a geomorphological part of the mountain range difficult. The upper terrace that cuts across the fan and is roughly followed by the O&L line is neither a unique nor continuous landform feature. This terrace has been eroded and then buried over a length of almost 500 metres by subsequent fan activity. The fact that there are two terraces also makes it difficult to understand the rationale behind using one of these terraces as a landform contact. Geologically, there is no difference between the part of the upper fan landform that lies above the O&L line and that below. Just referring to the two maps we've just received, what I've highlighted in red is the Alpha Fan. What was described as the Alpha Fan in the Environment Court hearing in 2002 was just the very upper terrace. So we're talking about approximately the upper third of the fan. And it describes this upper terrace as the toe of that structure. Well, in 2004, the Otago Regional Council started to look at this fan and structure in more detail. In 2011, they put out a detailed report on alluvial fans in the Otago area. And they've mapped it pretty much as the exact same extent as my geological map. The second map, has highlighted the two terraces that I mentioned in the summary. So both of these cut across the alluvial sediments. You can see the upper terrace feature is roughly what's been used by the 2002 decision as an O&L line. It of course is not the Toba fan, it is an erosional feature created by a river that would have drained the base added valley. And there's a second terrace, roughly parallel, that's further down slope. So this river system would cut the upper terrace first, and then shortly after, as the base level of the valley is dropping, cut the second one. Just to go back to a point that was made earlier, on ONF versus ONL, it was mentioned, are we actually looking at an outstanding natural feature rather than the landscape? I mean, the 2002 decision seemed to hinge on the fact whether this alpha fan is part of the mountain range or part of the valley floor. I mean, geologically, it's clear cut. It's alluvial, so it's part of the valley floor. It's not the Permian schist. It's not 250 million years their old mountain face. As a feature, it's not a particularly good example of an alluvial fan. In the original evidence, there's a photo of the Stevenson's Arm alluvial fan. It's figure 5 in the original evidence. And that's probably a much better example of a well-developed alluvial fan. The Mount Alpha alluvial fan, it has been eroded, but Stony Creek and Centre Creek have eroded a significant portion of it and filled it. There are two terraces that cut across it. And then, of course, there's been significant development on the lower part of the fan. So it's a significantly built environment on that lower part. So in terms of a natural feature, I would say there's much better examples elsewhere in the district.
Mr. Cleary, I wonder if you could explain something that's been puzzling me. I was putting these various diagrams, or geological maps you've produced, next to each other, and they all seem to have different shapes for this fan that we're talking about. And the one you produced today seems, to my untrained eye, to have a different shape again. Well, I accept that that's all certain evidence. So, I started with your figure 1, and I suppose the thing that I'm looking for, my correct, I'm looking for Q1A,
okay.
And it goes effectively the entire length of the Royce Bay, that's that one.
And that is Q1B. See the little dash? Between the words Roy and Bay, it says Q1B.
So that's the missing link.
That's beach deposits from the lake. As the Clutha River is cut down through the terminal moraine, the lake levels dropped over time and left these stranded beach deposits. If you look at really old photos of Lake Wanaka, you can actually see the old beach before the tender was a lovely rugby field, football field. You can actually see the beach terraces there. So, yeah. Well, I'll submit some more maps on that question because. The first is the map from the Geological Nuclear Sciences, which pretty much shows it's a much bigger scale. It's one of
those. So that would help. My eyes aren't good up to.
It's in that upper lesson there. But you can see it's pretty much exactly the same shape as Umamiya. They obviously have walked over the farm. I spent a number of days traversing the farm. Digging holes, taking samples, mapping it in detail. But the correlation was remarkably good since they were probably relied mainly on air photos, satellite images.
So just before you go further, so this the source of this is GNS?
Yeah, Geological Nature Science. Yes.
Beth, recall, what exhibit number are we up to?
15.
So the next one is 15?
Yeah.
Recall this one is 15?
Mm-hmm.
The other one's the same. So the beach deposits explain the microscopic.
Yeah.
And
I mean, if you wish, you can have a look at
that. Like, I'm just trying to understand it. Like, I don't think we're going to, in this particular panel, we're not going to crawl over the land and study these rocks at that level of detail. I'm just trying to understand your evidence.
Okay. If you wish to have a look at the full government map, with legends, etc.
And in terms of the comparison you've drawn, between Mount Alpha Fan and Stevenson Arm Fan, from the photo you produced of Stevenson Arm, it's obviously a very extensive fan. Does it have the same character as Mount Alpha in terms of being at the base of a mountain range?
It's not as steep, but it is where one of the key features of the Maliba Fan is where a stream exits a steeper slope. The water has high velocity. It's erosional. When it hits the flats, the flatter land, the water velocity decreases. It can't carry as much sediment, so it becomes depositional. The other key feature of a fan, of course, is that it's not just constrained in one channel. So on that flat land, the channel will migrate across the fan surface. So it displays all the characteristics of a well-developed linear fan.
What I've just written down, and I want to read it back to you, make sure I've got this right, is you said it's not as steep, but the existence of a fan is the product of water coming down the hill at velocity and meeting a slope of lower gradient.
Exactly. So it goes from erosional to depositional, depending on the water velocity.
Thank you very much for those maps. They are helpful, even though there's a recurring theme, but what seems to strike me again from the Unchanged Eye is that there are variations on a theme, almost that there's a the edge is not 100% accurate in each one.
Again, the other map I've provided is a Targa Regional Council mapping. So they're more interested in the hazards, etc. Again, they visited the Stony Creek part of the system, the because of the concern that that part of the system goes through housing developments. The rest of it, they've not walked in any details, as far as I can tell. They would have done most of the work on aerial photography, satellite images.
Yep.
Whereas I have actually walked the whole concept of the farm. I have spent more time up here. So any discrepancy is likely to be basically someone looking at a computer screen, the satellite image, versus me actually walking with my geology pick to get an exact location for the contact.
Yeah, and it's been described as the environment court described it as a tool of the plan. So if you actually looked at it as and just to try and help a non-geologist, get a grip to it, if you actually looked at it as, instead of a tool, if you looked at it as a foot with the extent of the tool being, the big tool being the one that runs down to the lake, and the little tool being the upper fan that we're looking at.
Yeah.
So because we've lost the big toe, does that necessarily mean you cut off the rest of the foot? Do you understand where I'm coming from?
Maybe. the shape is largely controlled by the terminal moraine.
Yes, sir.
So you can see it's a composite alluvial fan. There's two main tributaries, the largest being Stony Creek, and then obviously comes right down to Roy's Bay.
Yes.
The second largest catchment is Centre Creek, so it's right in the middle of the alluvial fan.
Yep.
That actually comes down, hits the terminal moraine, and turns north and joins Stony Creek. And then there's a whole lot of smaller tributaries with no names, which only flow through flood events.
Yep.
That's when alluvial fans are active. Heavy rain, flood events, etc. If you go up there now, Centre Creek may well be dry. There's water coming off the hill. Where it hits the alluvials, it goes underground. I mean, Stony Creek is flowing most of the year, but even in the summer that will be dry. But a lot of these very small tributaries are dry all year round. It's only when you get a flood event, heavy rain, the material is actually being transported that they're actually active. So yeah, the shape is also partially to do with the terracing event, but geologically, for all intents and purposes, I mean, alluvials in a fan sequence and the alluvial outwash gravels, which are deposited when the glacier terminated at Wanaka, and you know, a glacier is a huge sediment transportation machine, basically, it's a conveyor of the sediment, and you get a huge amount of sediment washed out front of the glacier. We call these outwash gravels. From here to Hawea, there's huge terraces of outwash gravels. Geologically, there's very little difference between outwash gravels and the fan itself. It's all alluvials, it's a slightly different landform. And this landform, you can see, is geologically as I said, there's no difference between the upper terrace or the sediments down there in West Bay. Baronel does not cut across a geological content. It's the same above and the same below. But yeah, the shape is controlled by moraine, by terracing, and by the size of the streams.
I'll agree that the shape is controlled by nature, but it's certainly affected by humanity. And thank you very much for Stevenson's arm photo. It's a very good photo. But you can see in that photo the impact of recent farming activity, which is a big circle at the top, which I presume would be a pivot irrigator or a place.
Yes.
So I'm just trying to get my head around what's geological and what's been affected by.
Yeah. Stevenson's arm is not inside the O&R, just out of interest.
Yeah, got that point. I think the rest of it is for And just one final question. On the, you mentioned quite that it's not a significantly good example of an Olivial fan. Is that something that is a quality of judgment? Is there a basis for that in any other guiding principles that we look at? Or, I'm not a very good quality example of a Scotsman, but that's not easy to exclude me.
Yeah, I suppose because it was mentioned that maybe we're looking at an outstanding natural feature, it went through my mind, well, you know, is this a good example of this landscape, natural feature? And also in Meltzoff's evidence, she mentioned that, you know, maybe this is a feature that's worth preserving. So I did some research on Olivial fans in the district, and if I was taking a field trip to show students an Olivial fan, I'd be taking them probably to Stevenson's Arm. You could take them to the Queenstown CBD. That's on the Olivial fan, right? Downtown Queenstown is an Olivial fan. It's probably like one for geologists because you can't see it so well. But
calling this by theory, it's a feature, but it's not an outstanding one.
Probably. But yeah, the Stevenson's Arm one, it's just a nice example of a really well-formed one. It's farmed, but it hasn't really been impacted by processes that hide the landforms, so to speak.
Is that the geologist's training, that you can look past the cultivation and see the rocks underneath?
Maybe. I mean, that may be the problem that happened in 2002, was they weren't looking at the landform of the geology, or the geomorphology. Therefore, they looked at the upper terrace, which is, there's no buildings up there apart from my own house, so to speak, rather than the landform as a whole, which is true extent is much larger than they were describing. So they ended up saying this reads with the mountainside, but you know, if you say, well, no, that landform runs down to Royce Bay, but it's covered in houses, so it doesn't particularly look like a fan, maybe it would have made a different decision, I'm not sure.
Just for my benefit, can you explain to me the difference between geology and geomorphology? I could look it up in a dictionary, but I'm sure you'll have.
Yeah, geology looks at the processes on how rocks and landforms form. Geomorphology is the physical character of the landscape as described by the underlying geology.
So, is a geologist also a geomorphologist, but a geomorphologist might not be a geologist?
You're talking about the difference between geologists and geographers now. Right? Geologists look at the processes that create our landscapes, etc., whereas geographers can look at the surface of our land. So, they can talk about the glaciers and the landforms as well, but they're not necessarily going to talk about the underlying processes that created them, if that helps.
We're all good. Thank you, Mr. Leary. Thank you for improving my education. Can you give another respect? Eventually become very wise. Papers in order. Have your summary, so please proceed.
Thank you. My name is Hannah Marriott. I am a landscape architect. I practice Rockingbell Landscape Architects. I've been engaged by Walkinder Limited to provide landscape evidence in relation to two separate proposals. The first proposal assesses the current position of the outstanding natural landscape boundary of the Mount Alpha Range and suggests a more appropriate alignment of this. The second proposal assesses land zoned rural general visual amenity landscape and suggests rezoning to rural lifestyle zone rural residential zone. It is important to note that each proposal, while interrelated to some extent, is independent of each other. In my evidence in chief, I refer to a comprehensive landscape assessment of Hawthornden Farm that I prepared in 2015. This assessment provides a thorough description of the farm, accompanied by site photos that illustrate the landscape character of the farm and its context. The assessment goes on to evaluate the current position of the ONL boundary, as shown on the proposed district plan, that is the result of a finely balanced decision made by the Environment Court in 2002, and suggests a more appropriate alignment that excludes the office fence. It also identifies those areas of Hawthornden Farm that I believe are able to be rezoned for living opportunities while adhering to the objectives and policies of the proposed district plan. Ms. Helen Malsop has provided Section 42A evidence and rebuttal evidence responding to the Hawthornden Farm proposals on behalf of the QLDC. In her Section 42A evidence, Ms. Malsop disagrees with the proposed ONL boundary position and believes it should remain generally as it is shown in the PDP. Ms. Malsop does not oppose rezoning of areas A and C from rural general zone to rural lifestyle zone and suggests rural lifestyle zone instead of rural residential zone in area B. In her rebuttal evidence, Ms. Malsop stands by her original position on all matters and highlights areas of my evidence that are perhaps overstated and incorrect. I summarise our opposing and agreeing positions below. The ONL boundary alignment, whether to include or exclude the Mount Alpha fans. Ms. Malsop and I agree that the ONL line is inaccurately drawn across Hawthornden Farm on the PDB's planning maps. However, we disagree on the general alignment of the ONL boundary. Ms. Malsop believes the ONL boundary should generally remain in its current position to include the upper terrace of the Alpha Fan landfall. I assess the entire landform to have a moderate to low level of natural character due to moderate to high levels of modification. While I consider the landform as legible, I don't believe the geomorphological characteristics of the landform are particularly unique within the region. It is therefore not natural or outstanding enough to meet the ONL criteria. I believe classifying landscapes such as this as ONL degrade the concept of ONL and dilute the significance of those landscapes that are truly outstanding natural landscapes. In my opinion, the Alpha Fan should be excluded from the Alpha Range ONL and zoned RLC in the PDP. I believe the ONL boundary should follow an obvious change in topography, geology, land cover, and land use between the two distinct landscape character areas of the Mount Alpha Face and the Alpha Fan. Please refer to the image attached to this summary, which clearly shows the distinction. It appears the differing views between Ms. Malsop and I stem from an underlying discrepancy around the degree of naturalness that should or should not be required of a landscape in order for it to be classified as an ONL. I believe an ONL needs to have a high level of natural character to be classified as an ONL. Ms. Malsop, and I quote, does not agree with this premise that a landscape must first achieve a certain grade on a scale of naturalness before it can be assessed for outstandingness. Under the RMA, a landscape does not have to be unmodified to be natural, just relatively unmodified. In assessing a landscape, the issue most often is the degree of the natural component compared to the degree of human modification and the balance of dominance of one over the other. Following this, it is my understanding that a number of landscape studies, including the Christchurch City Landscape Study undertaken in 2015 and the Ed McKenzie Basin Landscape Study in 2013, along with court decisions, adapt a threshold approach to the evaluation of the landscape, similar to the one I use in my assessment. An example of this is the interim decision for Plan Change 13 for the McKenzie Basin, in which the degree of naturalness necessary for a landscape to be an outstanding natural landscape as discussed by Judge Jackson. In her rebuttal evidence, Ms. Malthoff claims that in my evidence, I have overstated the current restrictions on farming activities within an ONL, and therefore such restrictions should not be a reason to reassess the ONL boundary. Ms. Malthoff's clarification of the rules in the ODP and PDP is in fact correct. There are no particular restrictions stated on the farming of shelter belts or other horticultural and agricultural uses within ONL, so long as they comply with the site standards. I think it is fair to acknowledge that controls over the location, size and appearance of farm buildings within ONLs are in fact more restrictive than in rural landscape zones. For example, a permitted farm building on an ONL is restricted to no more than 100 square metres in ground floor area, whereas a permitted farm building within the RLC is allowed up to 300 square metres. Any farm building that exceeds the size, density and height standards for ONL, which I would imagine many practical farm buildings would easily exceed, are a restricted discretionary activity and are subject to the assessment matters under 21.7 of the PDP with regard to landscape character and visual amenity, i.e. subjective assessment matters and a costly consent process, most likely requiring a landscape and visual assessment. At paragraph 3.33, Ms. Malthoff writes, in my view, the ONL classification does not unduly restrict farming use of the land. I consider that the PDP would not result in any meaningful increase in restrictions on farming activities. I think what Ms. Malthoff is saying here could actually be used to strengthen my argument that the alpha fan should not be an ONL. Unlike many ONLs of the region where intensive farming is not suitable for practical reasons, i.e. they are mountains, lakes and rivers, further buildings, vineyards, crops, shelter belts, irrigation and earthworks are farming practices that are very likely to occur here on the Alpha Fan. If the ONL classification of the Alpha Fan does not restrict these farming activities, what is the point of protecting this landscape as ONL? Would the existing landscape and visual amenity associated with this landscape not be equally as protected under the rural zoning? As per section 6B of the RMA, ONLs are matters of national importance, which must be protected from inappropriate subdivision use and development. This is given effect to under Objective 6.3.4, Policy 6.3.4.2 in the PDP, which recognises that many ONLs include working farms and that viable farming activities may modify the landscape provided the quality and character of the landscape is not adversely affected. The Alpha Fan is a landscape that lends itself to intensive farming practices. As a result, it has been cultivated for more than 100 years, 125 years, and now has a strong pastoral character. Although planting of exotic shelter belts or vineyards and the construction of small farm buildings and tracts are seemingly permitted activities within ONL under the PDP, they are activities that would, in my opinion, add to the pastoral character of the Alpha Fan and continue to adversely affect natural character. Under the rezoning heading, I propose, and Ms. Malthoff concurred, that there are areas of Orpington Farm lower terraces that could absorb rural lifestyle zoning without significant adverse effects on rural character and visual amenity values of the surrounding landscapes. These areas are shown as Area A and Area C. Oh, sorry, I haven't filled in the sheet numbers. They're, I can refer to them. Now, appendix to my evidence is a summary of the assessment graphic material, and I confirm that you're A and C on sheet 6. Oh, you're looking at C. The landscape assessment. It is. Yeah, sheet 6.
What page, please?
I have a page. I haven't got page numbers on the graphic attachment.
Third last.
Yeah.
Third last page. What's it?
Oh yeah. This one.
No, yeah.
Rural lifestyle zone allows for one residential unit per hectare with an overall density of one residential unit per 2 hectares across the subdivision. Area B, as on sheet 6, is an approximately 15 hectare area of gently sloping land connected to the end of Studholme Road, currently zoned RLC in the PUP. I'd advise Hawthorne Dunn Limited that a rural residential zoning would be the most appropriate zoning for this area. Ms. Malthop disagrees with me and suggests rural lifestyle zoning would be more appropriate, as she believes it would achieve a higher level of rural character than the rural residential zone, which would result in continuous buffer of rural living character along the southern side of Studholme Road. I remain of the opinion that rural residential zoning would be the best use of this land, as a slightly higher density than what is required in the rural lifestyle zone could be achieved without compromising the rural character of the peri-urban zone on the edge of the urban growth boundary. The intention of the rural residential zone was to provide living opportunities on the periphery of urban areas. The zone allows for development density of up to one resident every 4,000 square metres, while giving the council control over the bulk and location, colour and light standards, and where required, design and landscaping controls at the time of subdivision. I believe these controls will be sufficient to maintain rural character in this area. However, Ms. Malthop raises concerns in paragraph 3.39 of the rebuttal evidence over the provisions of the proposed district plan rural residential zone, and the fact they do not provide certainty that covenants or conditions would be imposed. This is more a planning issue, which I will leave to the planning experts to discuss.
Thank you, Mazeez.
Sure. Mazeez, in terms of the summary, did you want to tell us anything about the photos you've attached to it?
Oh, of course, yes. I've pulled out these photos from my landscape, my original landscape assessment, because I believe they are actually the best way to determine different landscape, well, see visually the different landscape character areas we're talking about here. And also just to show exactly where I think the ONL should go. The top one is a view from the top of Mount Iron, which I understand is a very important public view, and I would agree with that. But it looks out across over Wanaka, and you can see Hawthornden Farm in the context of urban development at the base of Mount Alpha Faith. It's quite clear, particularly at the time of year that I took this photo, the difference in colour. But I do note that at times of year such as this, where it all seems to be one continuous colour, there is still a texture difference, which is quite evident in this photo between the very, I would say, highly textured Mount Alpha Faith and then the very smooth Alpha Fan. So this was the view that I used to define landscape character areas. Help to find landscape character areas, which is all part of my methodology for assessing where the ONL boundary should be. You can actually see the entirety of the Alpha Fan in this view, including the parts that have been developed. The photo B is basically showing, in real terms, on the ground terms, where the ONL line is currently drawn. And you can see it kind of wavers quite a lot up and down that terrace face, which is, yeah, I mean, methodology for mapping those lines is something that has been discussed at length, I believe, but it's not well drawn on the proposed plan, so that would obviously need to be addressed.
It's a particularly thick black pen that Judge Jackson employed, I suspect.
And so 150,000 scale map is not terribly helpful. And then photograph C is showing where I believe the ONL line should go. And you'll note that it doesn't follow, I could have drawn the Hawthenden Farm boundary on this photo to show the exact correlation. It doesn't follow the exact Hawthenden Farm boundary. It follows the change in topography, which I find more important than a property boundary in this case. It includes landslide material within the Mount Alpha face, but it excludes all of the alluvial deposits, which are quite a different gradient. And photograph D is from standing on the top of that alpha fan, right below the turnip paddock. And I think this view most clearly demonstrates the pastoral character of the alpha fan. And also clearly demonstrates the topography change that we can see up the top there as well. It's quite clear where you should drive your farm vehicle and where you probably shouldn't.
Yes, Commissioner, they are right at home among the thistles up there. Apologise. Aziz, why don't you put this way before I get back over to Commissioner? Something I should ask you before it goes out of my mind. One of the crosses we have to bear during this hearing is we walk around Wanaka looking at different landscapes all the time that are the subject of the hearing. And I have repeatedly driven from Ardmore Street down Brownston Street and then framed, I think it's up on Hawthenden Farm, is a very prominent house site. And I wonder if you could, if you know what I'm talking about, if you could locate it on the plan so I can get a reference point relative to the material you've given us.
Sorry, just so I can make my double check. But the house that you're referring to, and this is the view, I imagine, you're talking about the Brunston
yes.
Street.
Yes.
And this is the house site. That the house site is up on the top of. So it's actually the white line is kind of hiding it, that is up in this area.
Right, so it's the top, it's sitting at the top boundary of the area around.
Correct.
Thank you for that.
So, on the matter of the photos attached to your summary, one of the things I've been pondering has been to understand the proposed ONL changes you're recommending in the context of the ONL around it. For instance, in photograph A, I suspect most viewers wouldn't only look at that one little bit of that mountain range next to the Hawthenden Farm. They probably take in that whole vista. Are you in a position where you might be able to augment these photographs by showing us the ONL lines proposed outside of the Hawthenden Farm area, that also include on them the changes you recommend, so that we might get a clear and analytical understanding of the net outcome we're being asked to support?
So you would like me to show the ONL line across all of
yeah.
photograph A
That would be something I would find very helpful to understand the context of the changes.
Sure.
Is that something that can be done reasonably simply? If it's
yes, it is. Do you want me to hand draw, or would you like me to do it?
Well, let's have a discussion on both sides of what's the most practical. I'd like the most accurate information possible, but at the same time,
sure.
We're in a process that doesn't have much mercy for huge time delays. So,
if we were to ask you to provide that information, is on the alternative that you've provided us with high quality images here, would it be much trouble and take much time for you to extend that and provide us more? So we have something that's directly comparable?
I can shoot to the office and...
No, I'm not talking today.
Oh, you're not talking
today. I'm talking days rather than weeks.
Absolutely. Yeah. It would take a bit of time just to make sure I was getting that mapping accurate.
Is the end of the week unreasonable?
The end of the week.
Like you could have until the end of next week for that matter, but I think that if we see it while this is fresh in our mind, it'll mean more to us. So if you can do by close of business Friday to this Prendergast, that would be appreciated.
And are you happy for that to be just on photograph A, or would you like an even wider view?
I think it would be fairer to all participants to restrict ourselves to photos we've already been given rather than introduce new things.
Sure.
Okay, so I'm still on your summary.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still not, appreciating that this is a summary of what you've already said, I'm still not quite following the point that paragraphs 8 to 11 lead to the impact on farming activity. So, what is the point you're trying to make?
I'm trying to make the point that within an outstanding natural landscape, there is a lot more uncertainty about what you can and can't do. And there's a lot of farming activities that would trigger landscape assessment. And as soon as you do trigger landscape assessment, you're exposing yourself to all of the assessment matters, which are rigorous. And assessing visual amenity values. So, although the proposed district plan does permit more by way of actually permitting farm buildings to a certain size and height and everything, I think there are not many cases where the size of those farm buildings would actually be enough to serve the purpose for the farming activities. So, it's a tough one, and I think what Commissioner Robertson said earlier about is this actually the relevant point that we're discussing here? I mean, whether or not the activities are restricted in 9L actually is a secondary point or a secondary reason to put the O&L line where it should be.
Yeah, okay, because what I'd understood was that the first thing one does is identify an O&L based on whether or not it's an O&L.
Mm.
The question of what one then provides for within that as a matter of protecting from inappropriate use is a separate matter, isn't it? I've never heard before one not putting an O&L on land because we inherently assume that there'll never be an appropriate or anything that would be appropriate, which is what I thought you were saying, but you'll clarify that that's not what you're saying.
I'm not entirely follow up, I agree with parts of what you were saying just now. So in summary, I agree with what you were saying.
That farming may be restricted within an ONL is a matter to do with what's the appropriate use of land and what the plan provisions might provide for, not a matter that means you don't put the O&L there.
Correct.
Okay. Turning then to your actual evidence, your evidence too, possibly more flattering, sorry.
more detail.
Yes, forgive me. Probably been that late in the day. You talk at paragraph 6.4 about the PDP ONL wavering up and down that phase. And then at 7.3, you talk about the changes Ms. Malsop's identified. Were we, notwithstanding your evidence and the evidence of Hawthorne, but were we to prefer the approach of Ms. Malsop, is it your view that where she's got to with that line corrects the errors in that line? So this is not so much about should it be A or B, it's if we prefer Ms. Malsop's line, do you think she's got it right for what it is? Or is it still wavering all over the place?
For half of the the terrace that she's talking about, the lengthening that she's talking about. But as we've highlighted before, that terrace does dissipate. So again, that becomes a question of what landform is that really following
section
of that line.
So even if we were to be persuaded that the council has it right, Ms. Malsop's line is still what?
Along with a portion of it, yes.
Okay. Just for the complete avoidance of any doubt, I think I know the section of the line you're talking about, but again, it would help me if you could just identify for us on one of the relevant plans that extent that you think would still be wrong.
Yeah, actually, a good map. The house I bring it up?
Sure.
Warm area.
But it's when you get to basically from this section here through this section here that terrace phase is actually very hard to define, and it's actually difficult to define on the ground as well. This is Ms. Leary's map, which shows that it's basically when Centre Creek comes out and has eroded that terrace phase.
Is the reference point that shelf belt of pine trees?
That would. It's further back than that. It's not a bad reference.
There or thereabouts.
Yeah. I need to look at that.
That's the end of the clear terrace.
Actually, that sounds much. You can see from this photograph, you can see the looking at upside down. I mean, that's the terrace that ends at that point, and then it's sort of.
Okay. Okay, thank you. That's what I thought you were talking about.
Yeah.
All right. Stand down, everyone. Thank you.
By right, west of the shelter belt, have I got my directions right?
Yeah. West of the shelter belt is the degree.
At your paragraph 9.8. The way that I've read your evidence and
Ms. Leary's, and it's no criticism, it's just the way I've read it, is that it feels as if the focus has been whether or not all or part of the Alpha Fan of itself would qualify as an animal. And the evidence is very clear, at least from you and Mr. Leary, that it does not. What I'm more interested in is understanding whether or not part of the Alpha Fan, the Alpha Terrorists, should be included in the Mount Alpha O&L, even if they are different features, geologically and otherwise, from the point of view of the most appropriate recognition of the Mount Alpha O&L. And that's not a matter your evidence has really talked about. And again, I don't think it's a criticism, it's just the way I've read it. So what I would like to give you the opportunity to do is give me any comments you have on whether or not, even if we agree that the upper terrace of the Alpha Fan doesn't of itself meet enough of the criteria to be an ONL, does including it within an ONL as proposed by Ms. Nelsoff have a benefit to the public's appreciation of the Mount Alpha feature / ONL behind it?
Okay. You might remind me about the last parts of your question as I go on, but just initially, the reason we put emphasis on describing the Alpha Fan as a whole is because one of the degrees of naturalness that or aspects of naturalness that we assess is legibility and intactness of a landform. And we're pointing out the fact that a lot of the Environment Court decision that led to this ONL position was weighted upon the landform intactness and its legibility. But then I also note that the geology of that landform as a whole was not described to us, well, not entirely correctly. So that was sort of forming this, I guess, the background to why we put weight on the fact that we're not looking that the evidence, the Environment Court is not looking at the whole landform. So there's that aspect. There's also going back to one of the criteria of naturalness, and that is legibility of an entire landform. And you've also touched on, you know, what is the difference between an outstanding natural feature and an outstanding natural landscape.
Well, hold on that. Just to try and focus on an answer to the question at the moment. Which was, even if we were to agree that the Alpha Fan was not of itself an ONL, from the point of view of having an Alpha Mountain ONL and then immediately next to it a Fan ONL, the council's evidence is that, taken as a landscape view as a whole, the upper terrace of the Alpha Fan, irrespective of whether on its own it might have been a separate ONL or not, contributes to the Mount Alpha ONL such that it's appropriate that they be lumped together for landscape purposes. And so what I want to know is, because your evidence doesn't really talk about any effect on the Mount Alpha ONL from having a Fan part added or subtracted, that's what I'm asking you to give me a view on.
Okay. I believe excluding the Fan from the Alpha Phase would not degrade from the ONL of the Alpha Phase. They're quite clearly separate landscape units, and I think there's quite an easily definable line that exists between the two of them. So I believe they read as separate landscapes. A lot of that is to do with the land cover and land use that is evident on the Alpha Fan. And it's quite clear that there's part of this landform that is separate from the mountain range.
Can you turn to sheet 10? Of your and I'm looking at photograph 5. So this is the and this is the different landscape characteristics. I'm just reflecting on your answer about the court didn't look at the landform as a whole, etc. But as I understand your landscape character areas,
you haven't treated the fan as one whole area down to the lakefront. You've found other barriers and reasons to segment it up anyway. So am I missing something there?
Well, that's purely to do with name cover and the fact that the...
Hold on, your photograph 5 says landscape character areas.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't say landscape cover. But that's what you're to a character area. I see. Okay, thank you. Thank you. Now I understand. Just bear with me. Now, I have a feeling I know what your answer will be here based on your final paragraph of your summary. But at paragraph 10.5, I was very interested in understanding covenants and other conditions. And I just wanted to appreciate your difference with planning experts. But I just wanted to understand whether when you wrote that, you had in mind specific provisions that are in the proposed plan that would require it, or whether you thought it's just one of the things that good practice would take care of, because Auckland would employ eminently qualified experts such as yourself to make sure it happened. Well, which of those two did you have in mind?
The whole point of the rural residential zoning is that you are maintaining some rural character, albeit that they are, you know, one aspect of rural character is being lost with a high density. But I think that controls over the sort of setbacks from the road and, street lighting standards and how you deal with the road reserve would need to maintain some rural elements, i.e. no curbing. And also the building locations, building platforms is not a bad idea, although hopefully you can apply building platforms in a rural residential zone. But you can apply setbacks, and you can also, I would recommend that there are controls over the appearance of buildings in terms of their...
Well, you say there are, or you think there should be?
There should be, conditions.
Yeah, conditions of a consent, on the presumption that there would be restrictions of discretion directing a council to make that. Yeah, so basically plan-based. Okay. I just want to also talk to you about your paragraph 10.6. And so you agree, the RR zone is similar to the LLR zone, not necessarily a bad thing. I can understand what you're saying there. I wanted to put to you, do you think that may in fact be one of the reasons the council was reluctant to support it? The prospect of effectively almost premeditating jumping the growth boundary at sea is an important method. Is that fair? Or?
I think that's fair. That's one of the reasons.
I've been pondering whether to go here or not, but I'll do it.
You've got a pilot score for me.
You quoted several times the court's comment that this decision was a finely balanced one. Have you interpreted that as meaning there was a lack of confidence in the safeness of the decision, or just that it was a hard decision to make?
It was a hard decision to make based on the expert evidence and expert witnesses that they had. Judge Jackson, in that decision, wrote that he preferred the evidence of Ms. Lucas because it was a more thorough description of the landscape in which she described, you know, geomorphology and geology, etc. Northenden Limited did not have a landscape architect as an expert witness to counter Ms. Lucas's arguments. So there was a council landscape architect present Mr. SB, who I believe was of the opinion that the O&L line should exist above the Alpha Fan. But Judge Jackson didn't see that as very thorough evidence and felt that Ms. Lucas had a better argument on the day. That's what I interpreted from that comment.
And so, putting words in your mouth, I wasn't sure what you meant when you said finely balanced. But it sounds like you're suggesting that the technical grounds on which the decision was made, given what we're now being told might have been some inaccuracies, would have some likelihood of leading the court to a different decision had it had that information.
Yes.
Okay, and lastly, at 9.3 and 4, I'd have some nervousness agreeing with a witness that told me the court was unreasonable. So let's see if we can find a way to contextualise that word.
Well, put another way, would you be happy if the panel quoted those particular words for posterity in its report?
I was actually just giving you the basis of what I was going to talk to you about.
Indicating
to you that that's not a particular choice of words I found very helpful or endearing.
Sure.
So what I wanted to discuss with you was the quote that it says. And you talk about unrealistic reversible effects of farming practices. Do you think that what the court said might have been less unreasonable, as you said, if it was interpreted in a more general way to say, when you compare the effects of farming on the land to, say, a quarry, they tend to be less damaging and less permanent? Would that be a statement you'd agree with?
Possibly. I have to...
Because trees come and go, and the colour of the grass seed changes, but when you're quarry into the hillside, it seems to be gone forever.
Absolutely. And, no, you're absolutely right in that regard. What the court was referring to in terms of... I think was more in terms of land cover, and how if you were to retire the farm from farming practices, that it would be covered in scrub and therefore would return to its natural state. What I found unreasonable about that was the expectation that could ever happen.
I read the court decision as just talking about whether or not the effects are permanent or not. Not suggesting what a landowner should do for the benefit of the community.
Right.
But if you don't strongly disagree with me, which it doesn't seem that you do, that might help me. Deal with the paragraph. Thanks, that's important.
Thank you. While I'm sitting looking at your 10.7, this is, the discussion that rural residential would be preferable to large lot residential because you could continue farming operations. Have you thought about the operation of existing use rights?
Something I raised last night.
Stan. So what's the answer? When Mr. Whitnell asked you the question and said you'd better think about this.
So then, just to clarify in my what that means, is that even if it was zoned large lot residential, the existing use rights would allow farming to continue?
It's not my role to advise you on what the meaning and operation of Section 10 is, but I think of the RMA, but I think that you should assume that for the purposes of this discussion.
Thank you. It didn't occur to me in making this statement that the existing use rights would be a factor to consider here. More importantly, in this discussion, is the fact that in a rural residential zone, it's rural activities surrounding that zone are expected to occur, and so it's less likely that reverse negativity effects would inhibit farming activity, as opposed to if it was a large residential zone, then I think you would get a few more people complaining to council about farming activities.
Is that a human dynamic? Just the type of people who live in rural residential zones as opposed to are less likely to complain than the ones who live in large lot residential zones?
Yes, sir.
Now, there's one we discussed last week, the character of rural residential zones, and the evidence we have from council witnesses was that there is very little that's rural about rural residential developments, and we discussed rural residential developments that had occurred at Albertown and on the flanks of Mount Iron that look exceedingly like residential streets. And I wanted to give you the opportunity to tell me why that's not right and we should accept that rural residential developments are in fact rural as opposed to just that they're residential developments occurring in a rural community.
Well, they exist as a zone in the district plan. So, is there, you know, I shouldn't ask you questions, but maybe that's suggesting that rural residential zones shouldn't exist at all.
That's a possible conclusion, yes.
I mean, it does exist, and I believe, you know, driving along Albury Road, for example, we have got the new section of Albury Road that sort of heads along the back of the Albertown side of Mount Iron. Where rural residential exists along there, the road still feels more rural to me than urban because of the fact that there are no curbs along there, it's a gravel footpath, there are grass swales, there are post and rail fences, houses are quite well set back from the road. It doesn't feel to me like Kamoko, for example. It doesn't, and it also doesn't, to me, that landscape there doesn't actually lend itself to, it shouldn't be subdivided to a high density either. I think it's a suitable zoning and density for that area.
One of the responses that was given by, which I noted at the time, council expert was rural residential is essentially retention of a rural area where rural amenity is not important. So essentially, Albury Road, it's rural residential provides for. It's more residential than rural amenity. And I take your point about no curb and channel on the grass swales, but for all intents and purposes, it's a rural. But rural amenity as such is not as important as the housing component. I was just wondering how you feel about that statement.
The rural zoning around Mount Iron and the rural residential zoning around Mount Iron is a difficult one because rural farming practices do not occur in that area. However, we're dealing with, obviously, Mount Iron is an outstanding natural feature, and we're talking about the appropriate development that should occur around the natural feature, and therefore I think it shouldn't have high, you know, urban right up against the edge of that element.
I'll quote you, Mr. Goldsmith, in the fullness of time. I'm sure he'll appreciate your system.
Sure, if you are you
well, I've not finished, but you seem to be in the groove.
I wish. I've got a couple of questions. With regard to your editors in chief, there's an emphasis on the word fixed when you refer to the oil lines, but said by a fixed quotation mark going out. I was just wondering what you've intended by that. Is that a question or?
The word fixed O&L line was used in the landscape studies by Ms. Marion Reid and Stephen, and they were talking about the difference between O&L lines that had been drawn and decided in previous environment court decisions versus those that were perhaps discussed outside of the environment court. So this in particular, because this line was discussed in front of court, that was therefore quoted as a fixed.
Thank you. It's been, and again, 613, there's been a bit of mention made of the Wanaka structure plan. It is a non-statutory document and it is 10 years old.
Mm.
And my understanding is lots of the principles, maybe not the exact lines, but have been adopted in, council have adopted that over quite some time. I was just wondering, is it still worth noting? We're now 10 years on, and the points you make about it being included, is that still, in your opinion, a valid consideration?
I think the structure plan the structure plan was the last time that the community actually had a lot of involvement and talk and thinking about urban planning, apart from this, obviously, this district plan review. I think it is worth noting that in the past, the area of land that we're considering for rezoning now was once thought to be a good area for living. Obviously, as other pieces of land have opened up out at North Lake and out at in tree parks, which have happened over time through private plan changes and the likes, obviously that structure plan is no longer really relevant to today in terms of how much land there needs to be available for urban, because a lot of those bigger areas of land that have opened up is now essentially catering for what the council thinks the demand will be in the next 20 odd years. So,
No, that it sort of makes sense. Because especially when, and this is more related to Mr. Eggers' evidence in that a lot of mention about capacity and dealing with the national policy statement for urban development capacity, but we've had evidence that it actually says there is a lot of capacity already within the urban growth boundary, so that then questions the need to transgress the urban growth boundary. So that's all good. One of the other, in 8.7, you go on to reference the Wakadu Environmental Society in Queensland Lakes District. And a landscape, quoted, a landscape will be considered outstanding if it's conspicuous and eminent within the context of the area. And in here you put the district, and it's also been referenced in terms of the regional context, and it's also been referenced in terms of the national context. But if you actually look at your appendix, which is Appendix B, that you presented, the photo at the end, which is photograph 8. Does that make sense to you? Yes, it does. It's the Appendix B that was a graphic attachment to your evidence in chief. And it's page 19. photograph dates at the end. And that's essentially the view from the, roughly from the Caltex roundabout, looking down Branson Street towards what I think is Area E.
Great.
Yeah. Wouldn't you think that's conspicuous and eminent in that?
And that location. I think it's on the same view plane as the development on Ruby Ridge in this view. So Ruby Ridge isn't being developed actually in this photo, but it's under development at the moment, as you know. So in the context of that development, I don't believe it would be as conspicuous as it probably would be right at this point in time.
Commissioner, we're about lunch. Do you really...
I can come back.
You can come back. In that case, we'll adjourn for lunch break. Be back at 2 p.m.